Job said it clearly. Adonai natan, Adonai lakach, yehi shem Adonai mevarach. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The author of the book of Ecclesiastes said it poetically. For everything there is a season, a time for everything under the sun. There's a time to be born, there is a time to die. Eit laledet, eit lamut. Birth and death have always been seen in our classic tradition as natural and as inevitable. But in reality, both events were accompanied with great anxiety and suffering. Childbirth could often be fatal to the mother. The mothers of Israel must have faced the moment of birth with great fear. And death could be accompanied with horrible suffering. And then in the last century or so, medicine learnt the means through antiseptics and through anesthesiology to deaden the pain of death, to take away the anxiety of childbirth. And just when we thought we had rather well organized and managed our lives, the moment of entry and the moment of passing, we discovered that, as always, every solution breeds a new set of problems. That there was still pain associated with death, and there was still a number of very serious ethical questions to be associated with birth. They had lost their simplicity. It was clear that we now could tamper with the mechanisms of life in such a way as to create our own types of human beings. We've hardly begun to think through the consequences of that power. For the first time, we found ourselves facing a rather endless process of dying. Medicine could prolong life. But there was a new question. When was the body alive? Did the beating of the heart and the bellowing of the lungs describe life and define life? If so, one could put a young body on certain artificial life support systems and keep it alive for a considerable period of time. Who should go onto these life support systems? How long should they be kept on them? These were new problems. And they were more than theoretical. All of us know of friends and family, perhaps we ourselves, have faced the anxiety, the uncertainty of the kinds of decisions with which many are now faced. Shall the doctor do everything? Can we say to the hospital, the doctor, please, no more? We have lost our ability to define death. Point of fact, we have now the capacity to put a body in limbo by some process of deep freeze and to keep it in that non-life, non-death state for generations. Increasingly, death is a conscious act by man, the shutting off of a system, the denying of certain extraordinary treatments. We could keep rigor mortis from this corpse for a longer period of time than we do. Perhaps it's wise that we do not. But these are new questions, weighted with consequence. When we turn to our tradition, we find very little direct advice. Our modern medical miracles would have been to them science fiction, and they didn't even have a rudimentary science. The Talmud is a case in point. The Talmud has a very easy definition of death. No one has any questions about it. Death is the absence of pulse and the absence of breathing. The rabbis looked upon life as the greatest of the gifts of God. The preservation of life was a most sacred task, perhaps the most sacred of all. Everything should be done to keep a person alive that could be done. Pikuach nefesh, the saving of life, was the consummate virtue, a virtue that overrode every other demand, ritual or otherwise, that might be imposed on us. In the shorthand way the rabbis phrased this was to say, Pikuach nefesh dochet ha-shabbat. The saving of life can override even the required rest of the Sabbath. There's an interesting case in point cited in the Talmud. A building collapses on the Sabbath. People are trapped in the debris. And one is obliged to go into that rubble and to pull off the stones and the lumber and the beams and do all that we can to extricate and to save any who may still be alive. We do so even on the Sabbath. But we do not do so, according to the rabbis, if the bodies are known to be dead. Then the debris can wait. The digging out can take place after sundown. And so the question arises, how does one know whether those who are trapped are still alive? And the answer that's given is a simple one. We learn this by physical examination. You have to dig down to the bodies and take the pulse and measure the breathing. And how did they measure breathing? They put a feather or a mirror up to the nostrils. If the feather moved, if there was a mist on the mirror, there was still life. There was not, they left the person there and would come back after sundown. Now, obviously, we wouldn't leave it at that. All of us know of those who were dead by this measurement, whose hearts had stopped, whose lungs no longer pushed oxygen through the body, but who by any one of the modern medical ways, by electrical shock or heart massage or some chemical injection, were brought back, the vital organs began to pulsate again. We would keep on digging. And this leads us to our modern problem. Because it is possible to bring back into life the vital organs of those who are unconscious, whose minds may no longer, in fact, be capable of consciousness. For one of the effects of the breathing is to push oxygen into the brain. The brain cells require oxygen. And in a very short order, after oxygen is denied them, they atrophy, they disintegrate, they die. For all of its capacity, modern medicine lacks any ability to renew the brain cells. Once the brain has gone, it cannot be put back together again. So we find ourselves facing the kind of case which recently made the front page of our newspapers, where a young man from Wellington, Ohio, had been playing in the neighborhoods in a football game, and he had suffered some kind of concussion. He'd gone into a deep coma, and he'd been brought to the hospital, and put on a mechanical respirator, and kept in some kind of state. But it was very clear that his mind was gone. The electroencephalogram was put on, and there were simply no measurable brain waves. And you recall that his parents began to ask the hospital to take him off of the respirator. It was cruel enough that they had to face the fact of this son's death without having to live for weeks with a son who was dead, but was not allowed to die. And the hospital said no. It was unwilling to expose itself. And this couple was about to bring suit to force the hospital's hands if they could, when fortunately the young man died on his own. Now, in a number of states, this tension might not have arisen. 8 states of the Union now define death less by the traditional ways through the heart and the lungs as by what is called brain death. Brain death has been defined by a rather extended study group at Harvard University Medical School, who set up a number of criteria, which included an irreversible coma, a flat electroencephalogram taken over a 24-hour period, and the inability of the heart and the lungs to sustain themselves without artificial help. By these criteria, this young man was dead. And had he lived in a state which permits the definition of brain death, which allows the doctors to use this as the standard by which to certify death, the confrontation between these parents and that hospital in Elyria might not have taken place. And I was pleased to see that a legislator from Elyria had introduced a bill into our legislature to allow Ohio to come into the 20th century and to define death in these terms. Death could not have been defined in these terms before this century because we lacked the mechanical equipment to put onto a head and to measure the brain waves, but now we do. And we know that without consciousness, without bodily control, without memory, a body may still be pulsating, but it's a vegetable. It's really ceased to be a human being. But the problem of the achievement of legislation in Ohio, which will define death by the brain rather than by the heart and the lungs, will not solve all or most of our problems. Because so many of the cases which face the physician and families do not fall neatly under these categories. Again, recently, there's been a great deal of comment and discussion and coverage of the case of a young girl in New Jersey, Kathy Ann Quinlan, a young girl of 21 who went last April to a birthday party and did some drinking and took some drugs, and who slipped into a deep coma from which she has never roused herself. She became, in the words of the attending physicians, she was in a persistent vegetative state. Most of her brain functions had clearly gone. But she did not meet in her coma all of the categories of brain death, and New Jersey, in fact, does not have brain death legislation as yet. It was possible at times for her to sustain breathing outside the mechanical respirator for 10 minutes at a time. There was a little bit of measurable brain energy, though the doctor said that all the major parts of the brain had obviously been short-circuited from lack of oxygen, and she would never again, there was no hope that she would ever be in control of herself in any way, ever be able to walk or to talk or to feel or to react. In July, her foster parents signed a statement to allow the doctors to remove her from these mechanical life support systems. The hospital refused, and a case was brought and a case was tried in the New Jersey courts. The doctors described the damage as irreparable. She is 70 or 60 pounds in weight. She is a vegetable. But there were these moments where she could breathe. Her body was young. And there were these moments when there was some kind of minimal brain wave which could be measured. Her parents testified under oath that they had talked of the questions of life and death, and that all of them agreed that they would not like to live as vegetables, in coma, endlessly. Life was consciousness and awareness, capacity. Her Roman Catholic priest testified to the position of the Roman Catholic Church which is that one need not take extraordinary measures, which is the word that they use, in order to prolong death. When it's very clear that life is disappearing, is ebbing away, one need not perform extraordinary surgery or take extraordinary measures in order to prolong life. Her lawyer tried to define a new legal theory, which he called the right to die. He argued that every human being has certain inalienable rights, and among these are the right to terminate life when it becomes unbearable. The state argued that the state has an ongoing responsibility to protect those who cannot protect themselves. The state will occasionally intervene on behalf of treatment for a minor when the parents, for one religious reason or another, refuse that treatment. The state will intervene to protect the life and the dignity and the rights of the mentally retired and the mentally deranged, the enfeebled, people who cannot protect themselves, and they claim that this young girl fell into that category. And for all the sympathy that they felt towards her and towards her family, she was, by definition of the law, still alive. No one could certify her to be dead. And any taking of life by any kind of act was, in their minds, euthanasia, which is equivalent to a minor form of murder. The judge has taken the case under advisement. He's obviously trying to delay his decision. He would very much like this case to be mooted by this young girl's final death, because, as many recognize, the courts are really not competent to deal in these cases of complex medical decision. We would overload the courts if every time someone had to make a medical decision of this type, the case was referred to the courts. Moreover, since we lack a clear definition of death, there is no clear measure by which the courts can guide themselves. And many feel that the judge must, by law, make a very narrow and rigid decision, which would be unfortunate, in that, as things work now, many of you have talked to your doctors and told them that in case of grave damage to yourselves, you don't want radical surgery, you don't want heroic measures, extraordinary measures, and there's a kind of agreement which is operative. But if the courts begin to rule that life is whatever can be sustained by the mechanical systems, the doctor will be, under the law, impeded from doing many of the acts of kindness in which he limits himself, knowing he could protract this dying by an hour or a day or even a week. But he doesn't do it. He'd be afraid if the law comes down and with a very narrow decision in this case. In any case, the Quinlan issue makes it clear that even when Ohio and the 42 states which have not yet passed brain death legislation pass such legislation, the issue of the right to die, the issue of the people who are in prolonged coma, the issue of who shall go and when on a life support system and for how long, all of these issues will remain very much alive and very much with us. We pay a price for our great medical revolution achievements of this century. Now, I find myself very much in agreement with the Roman Catholic position. I find myself in agreement that when a person is dying, one ought not to prolong unnecessarily the death. I've been around death a great deal in my life, and death is rarely clean or lovely. Death is often painful. Death is often in a drug-related state. There's very little that's noble about death. Death and suffering are somehow associated in my mind. And I find it unreasonable, indeed unconscionable, for anyone to be subjected to a protracted period of dying when this need not be. I very often feel that it would be far better if people who are very ill, even terminally ill, who are given some ray of hope by radical surgery of one kind or another, if they would refuse the surgery. Somehow, to me, it's gentler to die composed in oneself than surrounded by the tubes and machines and all of that, which are the apparatus of modern medicine. I find myself sympathetic to the English experience, where in their hospitals and outside they have wards and what they call hospices, which are places where the terminally ill are brought, where there are there's no white starch nurse and there's no one attempting radical resuscitation. And if one requires drugs, one is given whatever drugs are needed to deaden the pain. Anyone can come in, any food can be given that is asked for, and one is allowed to die in these quiet wards with dignity, so much, as much dignity as can be allowed. But when I look into my tradition, I find very little support for this position, in part because the tradition has never faced it. Oh, I can find here or there an incident, a prayer, an expression which I would seize on. One that I love very much comes from a 12th century pietistic work, the Sefer Hasidim, written in the Rhineland by Judah Hasid and his disciples. Commenting on the text from Ecclesiastes, which I quoted at the beginning, there is a time to be born and there is a time to die. These pious men said, if a man is dying, do not pray too hard that he may revive. He can at best live only a few days. In those days he will endure great suffering. Therefore, the Bible tells us there is a time to die. And there's a wonderful story told in the Talmud about perhaps the most famous of all the Talmudic sages, Judah Hanasi, Judah the Prince, the great patriarch of the rabbinic academies of the Galilee. He died around the year 220, full of years and full of fame, and he had many disciples. And he apparently died a long death. There was in those days the belief that as long as one prayed around the bedside of a dying man, as long as one recited psalms, the angel of death couldn't get through the shield of the psalms. Prayer is saved in a very literal sense. And that's why in some of the pictures you'll see from the Middle Ages of a Jewish bedstead, it'll have around the top of it, the four-poster, a series of lines from the Psalms to protect the person at night from the Malach HaMavos, the angel of death. Well, in any case, the disciples made a ring around Judah Hanasi, and they recited hour after hour around his bedside these Psalms to keep him with him, to try to keep him alive. And the man was suffering. Poor man was in pain. But this was a loving thing to do, the disciples felt. But there was a wiser woman in the house, a handmaid who had served in this family for many years. And she saw the suffering of her master, and she went up to the roof just outside this room, which was his bedroom. She took a great big kitchen pot, and with all her might, she threw it down into the courtyard, and where it exploded with such a noise that all the disciples ran to the window. And in that moment, when they'd ceased praying, the angel of death was able to come in and take the soul of Judah Hanasi. There are things that ought not to be done. There's an old truism, where there's life, there's hope. And I don't believe it. At least when we define life as anything that's breathing, any heart that's beating. I would rather reverse the proverb. Where there's hope, there's life. As long as there's hope of health, as long as there's hope of revival, as long as there's hope that this person will again become conscious, that to me is life. And in those conditions, under those conditions, you do everything that's medically and humanly possible to save that life. But when the mind has been darkened, when the cortex has gone, when what you have is a human vegetable, that's not life. And the quicker that corpse can be put in the ground, quicker we can begin to deal with our grief, quicker we will all be able to get back to the ways of living. Now, there are not many any longer who disagree with that position. All of us have recognized that the pain and the indignity of endless suffering, the high cost in both emotion and economics. I've seen the college education of young people spent to keep an elderly grandparent in a coma, quote, alive for months until pneumonia finally came. But I think that we need, all of us, to be clear as to the limits of our concern. What are we really saying? What are we really seeking to achieve? There is, as you may know, a euthanasia society. Euthanasia, euthanatos, is a Greek word which means a good death, which has been circulating for a number of years now, what they call the will to live. It's a statement which is signed by an individual. It has no legal power, but they send it to their rabbi and their lawyer and their doctor and leave a copy for their family, indicating to them what their feelings are about extraordinary measures. I have a number of such in my file that have been signed by members of the congregation. And this is the text. To my family, my physician, my clergyman, and my lawyer. If the time comes when I can no longer take part in decisions for my own future, let this statement stand as the testament of my wishes. If there is no reasonable expectation of my recovery from physical or mental disability, I request that I be allowed to die and not be kept alive by artificial means and heroic measures. Death is as much a reality as birth, growth, maturity, and old age. It is the one certainty. I do not fear death as much as I fear the indignity of deterioration dependent upon hopeless pain. I ask that drugs be mercifully administered to me for terminal suffering, even if they hasten the moment of death. This request is made after careful consideration. Although this document is not legally binding, you who care for me will, I hope, feel morally bound to follow this mandate. I recognize that it places a heavy burden of responsibility upon you, and it is with the intention of sharing that responsibility and of mitigating any feelings of guilt that this statement is made. Now, what's indicated here is an attempt to free the family of guilt, to free the physician from a sense of confusion which he may feel as to what are the wishes in this case of this particular person who signs this statement when he or she is fully conscious, not under drugs or not in pain. And it asks two things. It asks the avoidance of artificial means and heroic measures, and it asks that drugs be mercifully administered for terminal suffering. I understand and appreciate what leads men and women to sign documents such as this. But I must say that I am troubled by some of the emotional environment in which such decisions are made. Not only is such a document like this not legally binding, but we have no institutionalized ways for the doctor to make decisions of this kind. And I'm fearful of what would happen once we establish such means. It assumes a benevolent medical environment. We have one generally in our hospitals. But very often extraneous considerations might intrude. They did in Germany. They could again. Considerations not of revival, but considerations of availability of bed space, usefulness of this citizen to the state, ability of this person to pay. These issues are obviously issues, real live issues in our hospitals. There are only so many machines. To keep a person under these machines is terribly costly. But we must move cautiously, I feel, into this area. And there is still in my mind a very clear distinction between an active and passive act. An active act I would consider the giving of a poison, the injection of oxygen into the blood. A passive act I would define as one in which nature, God, is allowed to take its own way. Seems to me that we must be very careful to protect human life from the pressures of the institution or of the state. And it seems to me also we must be very careful not to accept for ourselves a concept of life which is hedonistic, which judges life simply by capacity, by being in one's full, being in full control of oneself, the avoidance of deterioration. Let me give you the issue which has, the incident which has focused this problem for me. You may recall reading early in the year that the man who had been president of the Union Theological Seminary, Henry Van Dusen, and his wife had entered into a pact to commit suicide when there, at a given time, they would decide, and that they had in fact carried out this pact. In January this year, these two elderly people, they were both in their mid to late 70s, took an overdose of pills of one kind or another, and she died immediately. He lingered for several weeks. And they left a letter. The letter was addressed to friends and asked for understanding of the decision that they had taken. He had suffered a stroke some years before, which had impaired his ability to speak. She was crippled by arthritis. And the letter said, in effect, we have decided that we are both getting into a weakened state, we're beginning to deteriorate, and we do not wish to spend our last years in a nursing home. Therefore, this act. Now, I find myself, frankly, troubled by decisions of this kind. It seems to me that these two very capable people had begun to equate life with the capacities which we have when we are full of strength and in the middle years, full of health and able to do whatever it is we're able to do. But you know, there's a theological issue here. Have we the right to control life? Are we our own masters? Or do we accept the religious position that life is a gift from God, and we are simply the stewards of the life that He gave us, that we are given life for various purposes? And these purposes may not be simply to run a large theological school, or to give effective lectures, or to write important books. I can't help but feel that if these two people had not been so frightened of the last years, and had gone into a nursing home, a man and a woman who had spent their lives in the church, who knew so much about pastoral work, about listening, about the human psyche, might have done wonders for the others who were there, comforting, encouraging, bringing the Christian message to Christian folk. They denied themselves this chance because they defined life as what we have in the middle years. And they could not see how, as one grows older, there are other ways to serve. They had not reached senescence. They had not reached the position of terminal illness. There were still years for both of them. There were still many opportunities. And might not God have placed them on earth for that chance? Might not be the word of comfort spoken by one who is aging to another who is aging be precisely the word which encourages and revives the spirits? Certainly one who is in the same position is far more able to counsel than those of us who come from the outside and will go back outside. I'm troubled by the conversation which deals with what's being called death with dignity, which involves the fear of deterioration, the fear of aging. I'm afraid of it because it seems to me that we must protect at all costs our respect for life, And we must not allow the society to accept a definition of life as one which is full, or simply the fully healthy life, the fully productive life. Mr. Hitler went through the old folks' homes of Germany and killed everybody that was there because these were no longer productive. Are we willing to accept that definition? Obviously not. Is any of us willing to say that we have not been taught much by those who were no longer at the height of their powers? Taught something about humility, taught something about courage, taught something about what it means to live with, by marshaling one's strength quietly to face each day. It seems to me that there must be bounds to our discussions of the right to die. We must find the ways to free the medical people to do what needs to be done when extraordinary measures are not called for. But at the same time that we try to achieve this, let us not be so caught up in this theme of the right to die and death with dignity that we lose a sense of the worth of the aged, that we lose a sense of the possibilities of the later years. Now, many who are in their later years, I know, spend their days pointlessly, but that's not God's fault. There's much that could be done. And I know of people in the 70s and the 80s who comfort others, who teach, who offer themselves in friendship, who visit. And I know people in wheelchairs and who are bedridden, who somehow exude happiness and warmth and joy and make others feel better. That's part of life, a very precious part of life. Whatever his reasons, God gave us life, and he didn't give us life simply for the 30, 40 years in which we are professional folk. He gave us childhood, and he gave us maturity, and he gave us old age. All of these are part of God's plan. And simply because we face now a new problem, to limit the time of dying does not mean that we ought not separate our mind, aging from dying. They're two different things. For the dying, all comfort. For the aging, all support. There's a time to be born. There's a time to die. And between the time of birth and the time of death, there are many, many ways of living with dignity. Amen.